WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
America spends twice as much per person on health care than any other nation. Almost $5 trillion per year on health care. Over $14,500 per person, which represents a sixth of our total economy. Yet millions of people here do not have access to health care. Given how the government has savaged the agencies comprising the Department of Health and Human Services, I can't see how there can be any progress to make America healthy again.
That's Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on healthcare in America. The United States today has the dubious distinction of being the only major country not to guarantee health care for its population. Some 85 million Americans are uninsured. Half a million go bankrupt every year because of medically related debt. And we have one of the lowest life expectancy rates of any rich country. One out of four patients are unable to afford the medicine their doctors prescribe because we pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. Bernie Sanders says Medicare for all would save $650 billion a year and provide quality health care for everyone. There's plenty of money for the Pentagon, but little for ordinary people. We need accessible and affordable health care now. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's on the faculty of the Department of Health Systems and Population Health at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He's the author of Inequality Kills Us All, COVID-19's Health Lessons for the World. He spoke in Seattle in late September. And now, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka.
Major news outlets have some staff designated to prepare obituaries in advance of someone's death. I want to talk about the death of the United States. What does the obituary of this country look like? There are precedents, such as the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, predicting the death of the Soviet Union. Consider the strategy report, Make Our Children Healthy Again, released by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on September 9, 2025, as the equivalent of the Berlin Wall. What is at stake? At the helm of the HHS department is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated in 1968. He has no background in science or in any subject related to health. He attended Harvard as an undergraduate studying American history and literature. He then got a law degree from the University of Virginia in 1981, but failed the bar exam, although he passed it on a subsequent attempt and was admitted to the New York State Bar in 1985. His early years, 14 of them, he admitted, were spent addicted to heroin. He eventually became clean through what he calls spiritual awakening. His cousin, Caroline Kennedy, daughter of President John F. Kennedy, when she testified against appointing him HHS secretary, calls RFK Jr. a predator, saying he has a perverse sense of despair and violence. She talked about how he preys on the desperation of parents of sick children. RFK Jr. marketed the phrase, Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA, along with Trump's MAGA concepts, by producing products such as hats and T-shirts and sweaters emblazoned by this text. Let's explore this man's ideas. He is prone to making blatantly false statements such as, quote, we are now the sickest country in the world, end of quote. For 30 years, I've been talking about America's standing in the Health Olympics, namely the ranking of countries by life expectancy, which is the average length of life if mortality rates stayed the same. Exploring that measure, in the 1950s, we were certainly in the top 10 nations by that metric. I used the United Nations Human Development Report, published annually, where Table 1 lists each UN country and its life expectancy. In 2022, we ranked 44th, tied with Cuba. We had among the highest COVID death rates of all nations, but that does not explain the carnage. When I went to Stanford Medical School in 1970, we were 17th. When I entered Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in 1992, we were 22nd. In 2019, we were 36th. What this shows is that since the 1950s, many other nations have seen larger improvements in health. That is, they are not dying so young as we are. In fact, since 2015, our life expectancy has stagnated. That is, it is no longer improving and is in fact declining. All of our lives are being cut short, which is not a good sign. While many of you might say this doesn't apply to me, as I practice healthy behaviors and see my doctor when needed, it applies to all of us, you and me. We all die younger than we should. In 2022, we were about 7 life expectancy years behind Japan, which has been the longest lived country since 1978. To gauge that difference, consider that our 3 leading disease killers here are heart disease, then cancer, and then unintentional injuries. Together, they account for about half of deaths in the U.S. If we eradicated them so no one died of heart disease, cancer, or unintentional injuries, we'd gain about 7 life expectancy years and be among the healthiest nations. This measures how sick we are. We are not the sickest nation. The same UN list puts African countries such as Nigeria and Chad at the bottom, some 25 life expectancy years below the United States. There are about 150 sicker nations. So America is not by any measure the sickest nation in the world. But being sicker than all the other rich nations and a considerable number of poorer ones is not something to be proud of. RFK Jr. spouts many other false facts, such as half of people in China have diabetes. I could go on and list many more. The main point is that he's not a trustworthy source of easily verifiable factual information. Let's explore his Make Our Children Healthy Again report and strategy. The report, issued in May, has been widely discredited for having many false statements together with references that did not hold up. It was sloppily done, likely using artificial intelligence. However, on page 6, they correctly graph life expectancy and healthcare expenditure for 21 rich countries from 1970 to 2023. In 1970, the U.S. had lower life expectancy than almost all the other nations, and by 2023, it was far worse, demonstrating stagnation and decline that I mentioned above. To achieve this, America spends twice as much per person on health care than any other nation. We spend almost $5 trillion per year on health care, over $14,500 per person, which represents a sixth of our total economy. Yet millions of people here do not have access to health care. Pending legislation will make that worse. The Commonwealth Fund tracks the performance of health care in rich nations. Their study last year found the U.S. spending the most and having the worst medical care performance among 9 other rich nations, namely Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. While most Americans believe that it is health care that makes us healthy, that is not true. Studies show that the best that medical care in the U.S. can do is avert 10% of avoidable mortality. That leaves 90% to be explained by other factors. The most important of these is politics. The Department of Health in our longest-lived state, Hawaii, is very explicit in saying politics matters most. Yet in surveys, people rank politics last in terms of producing good health. Hawaii's Department of Health puts lifestyle factors and medical care as least important in producing health. Part of the problem is our language. We speak of accessing health, paying for health, getting health, ensuring health, when all those are about health care. If I ask someone, do you want health or health care, they are confused. With these concepts in mind, let's look at the recently released MAHA strategy report, which seeks to end childhood chronic disease by having policies to end the childhood chronic disease crisis. They plan to do this by having an NIH MAHA Chronic Disease Initiative to produce more research in which they call a whole person approach. They propose launching a real world data platform that aims to produce a single integrated data set for researchers. Then they list others, such as, it's a long list, new approach methodologies, cumulative exposures, autism, vaccine injury, water quality, air quality, microplastics and synthetics, prescribing patterns and impact on mental health, food for health, nutrition, repurposed drugs, precision agricultural technology, oral health and systemic disease connection, gut microbiome research initiative, longitudinal research for chronic disease prevention, longitudinal pediatric health insights, clinical trial networks, electromagnetic radiation, mental health and addiction research, rural and tribal health, and finally, artificial intelligence. This sounds like pie-in-the-sky daydream stuff. They want to reinvent the wheel. The rest of the 20 pages is similar in scope and lacks any references to substantiate that their efforts might work. My sense is they asked the latest artificial general intelligence program to compile this. The report contradicts many other directives the Trump administration has taken. It adds to the confusion throughout the Trump government. Given how the government has savaged the agencies comprising the Department of Health and Human Services, I can't see how there can be any progress to make America healthy again. Funding for research has been drastically cut. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has been emaciated. The situation is going to get much, much worse. Do we need more research to make America healthy again? No. We can learn from healthier nations as to what they did. I'll talk about Japan and how we, the United States, made it the longest-lived country later. What matters when it comes to making America healthy again? To begin with, we need a scorecard. We get what we measure. The report and strategy lacks any measure that we can follow to gauge progress. I propose we use our standing in the Health Olympics as the measure. Instead of falling in the ranking, let's get us moving up. The prevailing belief in the United States is that we are the best at everything. Every school child recites the Pledge of Allegiance daily, namely, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. This patriotic shibboleth implies we're the best. But Americans sense something is wrong in this country. They're not achieving the American dream, which is in fact a nightmare. That is, you have to be asleep to believe it. That is why they voted in someone who planned to drain the swamp and make America great again. Trump voters tend to be concentrated where our health is declining the most. Red states and smaller areas where death rates are rapidly going up vote Republican. Many killer facts verify this. Many of you know two people under age 65 who died. One of them would still be alive had they lived in countries like Australia, Canada, Germany, Japan, or Portugal. Fully half of all deaths under age 65 could be avoided if we had the death rates of our peer nations. Think of all the celebrities that didn't live long lives. Steve Jobs comes to mind. Most of us are impacted by his clever innovations. Yet he died at age 56. Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, died at age 65. I'm obsessed with being alive, so I focus on deaths. Death rates are a good indicator. Death is hard to fake, and we keep good records, as do all the other rich countries. No one in America can claim to be the healthiest person at any one time. The oldest old person is almost never in the United States. Most hail from Japan, the longest-lived nation. What is the medicine we need? It has to be political, as the health department in Hawaii points out. The two most important factors producing health in a nation are the amount of economic inequality present and the support for early life. Neither of these concepts are present in the material coming from the Department of Health and Human Services. Instead, the legislation that has been passed, the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, will drastically increase economic inequality, making the poor much poorer and the rich much richer than they ever thought possible. It is a big killer bill. The major reason is that before the Maha report appeared and more than 40 UN nations were healthier than we were, a massive transfer occurred from the bottom 90% of us to the top 1%. From 1975 to 2023, $79 trillion has been transferred from the bottom 90% to the top 1%, according to the RAND Corporation. Most of us have a hard time fathoming such big numbers. How much is $79 trillion? Suppose you took a stack of freshly minted $100 bills, our largest denomination, and stacked them tightly to the amount of $79 trillion. How far would it reach? A quarter of the way to the moon. That is how much you and I have had taken from us over the last 50 years, so the rich can be even more rich than they are. As Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen said, quote, "I believe that virtually all the problems in the world come from inequality of one kind or another," end of quote. The plan today is to make the richest person in the world, Elon Musk, whose wealth is close to $500 billion, according to Forbes magazine, to make him the first world's trillionaire. The board of directors of Tesla plan to offer him a pay package of $1 trillion over the next decade when the shareholders meet in November. The richest person in the world wants more, and it looks like he will get it. I can't think of anything more obscene. He needs to be told there are no pockets in coffins. That is, he can't take it with him. Some say high inequality is good for us, as it spurs economic growth, inspires competition, and produces better products to enhance our lives. But even the International Monetary Fund, which used to champion inequality as creating the conditions for economic growth, now has abandoned that trope. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis stated that in modern societies, you can't have both high inequality and democracy. 2,500 years ago, Plato said that for society to function, the biggest gap between the richest and poorest should be no more than 4 to 1. Today's ratio is around 1 trillion to 1. That helps explain why we no longer live in a democracy, but in a dictatorship. We live in an oligoklepto-plutocacistocracy. This translates into rule by a few, oligo, who steal, klepto, are rich, pluto, and incompetent, kakistocrats. Prove me wrong. Here is a list of some of the problems that stem from economic inequality. Worse health and higher mortality, less trust, more COVID deaths, more violence in society, more mass shootings, more obesity, lower scores on international educational outcomes, more corruption, and so on. We can also boast that we have the most mental illness of any nation. I have to be a little careful here, since diagnosing mental illness is not as accurate as diagnosing death. But studies over these last two decades confirm that America is driving us crazy. Mental illness is affecting younger and younger people, and not just mental illness. Close to 1,000 researched studies detail the harms of inequality. Take school shootings. Those of you who are younger will have likely experienced school shooting drills. From 2009 to 2018, there were 288 school shooting deaths. To frame that, how many were there in the rest of the G7 nations, a comparable population? 5. Over 50 times as many per capita here. These countries were Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom. American mass shootings are found in areas with high inequality and high incomes. Those studies are never reported when reasons are discussed. Instead, we look at firearm availability. We have close to 500 million civilian-owned guns, more semi-automatic rifles in public hands than in the military. Switzerland has a high gun ownership, although much lower than here, but no school shootings. No school shootings in Switzerland. Instead of recognizing a common source for all our problems, namely high inequality, we respond to each one separately. Parents buy bulletproof backpacks for their children, and there are regular school shooter drills in schools. We consume half of the world's drugs for mental illness here. We have novel GLP-1 drugs for obesity. Why not treat the source problem, namely our high income and wealth inequality, which stems from political choices, as Hawaii's health department point out. How to treat the inequality? Instead of reducing taxes anymore on the rich, we could raise them. Our minimum wage remains at $7.25 an hour since 2009. Why not have a maximum wage? This is not a crazy idea. In April 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed a maximum wage of $25,000 a year by having a marginal tax rate of 100% on incomes above that. While that tax rate didn't pass, in 1944, there was a 94% tax on the highest incomes, which was raised to 96% in 1946. The highest tax rate remained at 91% in the 1950s. But the rich have always wanted only one thing throughout history, and that is everything. So they work diligently to reduce the taxes they pay. In 2018, the lowest tax rate paid on combined federal, state, and local income was 23%, and that was paid by the richest 400 families. That is a smaller rate than the bottom 10% or any other group paid in taxes. Back in 1950, when we were one of the longest-lived nations, they paid a 70% tax rate. Recall Trump's big killer bill passed in July 2025 had an objective of maintaining the tax cuts on the rich from his first term and then lowering them even further. Consider this big whopper the biggest heist in American history. No matter what RFK Jr.'s Making Our Children Healthy Again tries to do, it won't work without tackling our profane inequality. My book, Inequality Kills Us All, details the harms we have.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on Healthcare in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
The other important factor affecting our health has to do with supporting early life. About half of our health as adults has been programmed by age 2. We need policies that support that period that are lacking in any of the material RFK Jr. presents. There are only 2 populous countries that don't have a national policy of giving a working pregnant woman paid time off after she has her baby. One is the United States, and the other is Papua New Guinea, half of a big island north of Australia. We are members of an exclusive club that is killing us. With less economic inequality, we can spend the proceeds on early life and leave Papua New Guinea alone as the only populous country without a national paid maternity leave program. Why is having time and resources to parent important for health? Recall, roughly half of our health as adults is determined then. We have no national program for free childcare, nor preschool, nor support for housing and transportation. Think of our unhoused population, so common now. Back in the 1960s, I saw only one homeless person. Now there are everywhere in America. There are many fewer unhoused in Western European nations. Take Sweden as an example of a healthy country that supports early life. There, it is mandatory to take a year and a half of paid parental leave at your full pay. Your father has to take about 13 weeks. The rest of the second year is optional at 70% pay. In your child's third year, she or he can be placed in a Swedish government-run daycare that is free. To work in such a daycare, you have to have an advanced degree in play. That is what daycare is about, socializing the child, and we need specialists to do that. Stress affects the pregnant woman as well as the fetus and causes worse health problems that continue after you are born. Consider stress as the 21st century tobacco. Few people smoke in the U.S. these days. Those that do are mostly poor, using tobacco to deal with the huge amount of stress they face. When countries are ranked by the amount of stress inhabitants have, the U.S. is right up there near the top. How do we cope with our stress? Consider that we consume about 80% of the world's opioids. Deaths from opioid overdoses number around 100,000 a year. There were very few 75 years ago when we were one of the healthiest nations. You might want to blame big pharmaceutical companies for pushing these drugs, but that source is mostly gone. It's been replaced by fentanyl and others. Why do we consume so much? It works as a stress reliever for a while, but then increasing amounts are needed for the same effect, and eventually an overdose does us in. Recall RFK Jr.'s problems with heroin as a stress reliever in his early years. Why are we so stressed out in the United States? We have all these technologies at our disposal. We can command information in a click or two. Artificial intelligence can provide many answers we seek. And given just about any thought or belief anyone can have, the internet will provide validation of that idea. You can believe anything you want and rest assured you are right. That should be very comforting, but for some reason it isn't. We are incredibly stressed out in America. Another way to relieve stress is with comfort foods, those high in sugar, fat, and salt. To begin with, the U.S. population is not growing in numbers, just in size. The food industry counts on growth, namely producing and selling more food to maintain profits. If there aren't more mouths for the food, then we have to get more food into the mouths we have. How to do that? Increased portion sizes and advertised mouth-watering foods continuously on social media and billboards and everywhere else. Food ads use a variety of tricks to make their products irresistible. Since Americans are some of the most stressed people globally, sugar and fat is added to most ultra-processed foods to make them physiological stress relievers. Changing the food industry tactics won't be easy for governments, as they have many lobbyists whose job is to persuade politicians to get people to eat more. What has been our response? We have a big market for huge caskets, for the embalmed corpses with Gertz, more than doubling in recent decades. You know that being too big is bad for your health, so the corpses are getting younger. Other accommodations include wider movie and car seats, as well as longer seat belts and double-wide wheelchairs. Besides growing the mortuary industry in this country, there are other reasons to be concerned. Infants dying are a sensitive indicator of a nation's health. In the 1970s, a French demographer, Emmanuel Todd, noticed that infant mortality rates were going up in countries of the former Soviet Union. He predicted that the USSR would collapse, although he didn't know when. His book, The Final Fall, an essay on the decomposition of the Soviet sphere, details his findings. The CIA began monitoring infant mortality throughout the world since its rise predicted instability. Guess what? Infant mortality rates are rising in the United States. Are we facing the same outcomes as the USSR collapse? Stay tuned. Are we ready to lower the U.S. coffin into the grave yet? No, I have a plan to stave off writing the obituary. Let's talk about the State of the Union called the United States of America. Article 2, Section 3, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution refers to the President's State of the Union message, stating that the President, quote, shall from time to time give to the Congress information on the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient, end of quote. Almost always, the President orates that the State of the Union is good. There has been only one recent State of the Union address where the State of the Union was not good. Specifically, in 1975, President Gerald Ford said, "I must say to you that the State of the Union is not good. Millions of Americans are out of work. Recession and inflation are eroding the money of millions more. prices are too high and sales are too slow. He continued, quote, this year's federal deficit will be about $30 billion. Next year's probably $45 billion. The national debt will rise to over $500 billion. Our plant capacity and productivity are not increasing fast enough. We depend on others for essential energy. Some people question their government's ability to make hard decisions and stick with them. We expect Washington's politics as usual, end of quote. Those were President Ford's words. He went on to say, I've got bad news and I don't expect much, if any. There was applause. The American people want action, and it will take both the Congress and the president to give them what they want. That was honest. Today, things are much worse in many, many ways. Just take the national debt, which is well over $37 trillion, or about 75 times what it was in 1975. Not good. So what is the State of the Union of the United States in comparison to other unions? When addressing our health in comparison to that in other nations, we're incredibly sick and die much younger than we should. Let's go back to the 1975 address by President Ford and see how we compare to other unions based on his remarks. I've already covered how much more debt this country have. We have taken on this colossal debt to pay for government expenditures. Remember that the federal government doesn't have to balance its budget. It can borrow to fund programs. Back in the 1950s, when we were one of the longest-lived countries, we had no debt. America incurred debt during World War II to pay for the war effort. That made sense. But it was quickly repaid. Who holds today's record debt? That is, who do we owe money to? U.S. bonds and other securities are held by some countries, such as China and Japan. Other big holders are U.S. corporations, as well as very rich Americans. We have to pay them interest. The annual interest on our $37,000 trillion debt is over $1 trillion. Thus, we increase the wealth of rich Americans and big U.S. corporations by paying them interest. Instead, we could have taxed them and not had the debt. Consider that a third of tax revenues received by the federal government goes to pay interest on our debt. Something has gone seriously wrong here. Instead of raising taxes on the rich, recall they pay the lowest tax rate, to fund the government, the Treasury borrows and then pays interest to those they should have taxed. This is never discussed when decisions are made to borrow more to fund the U.S. Treasury. What about other unions? Do they go into debt similarly to what the U.S. does? The answer used to be no. But as inequality has increased globally, so some other countries now have high debts too. President Ford said too many Americans were out of work. The situation today is very precarious, with all the federal job losses making people feel insecure. Average wages, adjusted for inflation, haven't changed since the 1970s. Yes, we employees are working harder and producing more, but employers are the ones who benefit and make more money. Ford also said that plant capacity and productivity aren't increasing fast enough. Today, with the tariff roller coaster rides, businesses don't know what to do and will mostly try to stand their ground. Tariffs are taxes paid by the importer. We used to call them duties. They will increase prices that Americans have to pay. This is how the federal government is increasing taxes, which are what the tariffs represent. At the same time, by continuing Trump's massive tax cuts on the rich and big corporations, it will be the rest of us who shoulder the burden. The state of the American Union is worse than not good. It is disastrous. What do we have that might be considered the envy of other unions? Vast military might. But that is leading to genocide elsewhere. We have as many billionaires as any other nation does. Billionaires have tremendous power to tell us what to do. Maybe that is not so good, as it erodes American concepts of personal freedoms. What should the president propose in his State of the Union? Something along the lines of, "My fellow Americans, this country has fallen into a state where it can be called a sick society, and our sickness is the system we are in. This has happened before, and we rose to the occasion. Older people that remember 1957 can recall the frightening news that the Soviet Union had launched a satellite, Sputnik, into space that was spying on us. They followed sending a dog into space and then a human. We were caught totally off guard, as we had yet to begin a space exploration program. We vowed to land a human on the moon by the end of the next decade. With a goal, we developed plans and tested components to show we were making progress. And in 1969, August, we showed on real-time television that we had accomplished our goal. The news of this success quickly traveled around the world. While improving our health to become one of the longest-lived nations on the planet is not so visually apparent as stepping onto the moon's surface, we could monitor our progress by posting our living longer, healthier lives in comparison to the other countries on social media, on news reports, and incorporating this into educational materials such as textbooks and whatever is replacing print media in schools. What gets measured gets done. That is what she or he could say. One other strategy would be to encourage more immigration. Immigrants tend to have better health outcomes than those born in the USA. We should knock down the walls and not deport anybody. Supporting immigration will even improve the health of those of us born here. It is a win-win situation. Another perspective on the political medicine we need is what we gave to Japan after the Second World War that made that country the healthiest country in the world by 1978. During the U.S. occupation of Japan, we wrote their constitution. The country was forbidden to have an army and had to resolve all disputes peacefully. There was a clause in the constitution making the government responsible for the health of its citizens. Labor unions were also legitimized there. The large corporations were broken up, and the most successful land reform program in history was carried out. We also legislated a maximum wage in the country. Japan then enjoyed the most rapid decline in deaths ever seen on the planet and became the longest-lived nation by 1978. What we gave them is a tested and proven medicine. How do we create awareness of our health being so poor? Unlike the Sputnik launch, where we could see a picture of the satellite and hear the signals being broadcast by the satellite from space, there's no image of our health as a nation to present. One challenge in getting these ideas across was voiced by Upton Sinclair years ago when he unsuccessfully ran for governor of California. He found that it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That is what we face in this country. People are paid to not understand what is happening and why. Critical thinking has all but disappeared from the educational process. But there are ways to change that. One way to make younger people aware of our plight is to put the question, how healthy is America, into the standardized tests we take beginning before high school. Follow this with questions on the SAT and other exams we take to get into college. Then specialty tests such as the MCAT or Medical College Admissions Test or the LSAT Law School Admission Test and others. Even the exams that medical students take to become doctors lack them. If such questions were on the test, then we would prepare students to be able to answer them. Even public health schools are not required to compare U.S. health with that in other nations. So even our supposed experts are not aware of our being dead first. Another strategy would be to seed our entertainment channels with the state of our nation's health. Movies almost never feature the plight of poor people who have the worst health here as major characters. Hollywood caters to large ticket office receipts as the values that drive production. A wild and crazy idea would be to subsidize the entertainment industry the way the government used to subsidize research to produce new drugs that were then handed to the pharmaceutical industry to amass huge profits. Having a healthy country would make us more productive and innovative. The values of our federal government are taking us in the opposite direction. Looking further afield, the global goal would be for all nations to tie for the gold medal in the Health Olympics. Trying to accomplish this would change the structure of the world system and end the exploitation that has brought us to this dangerous precipice. Sound crazy? Of course. But presidents can inspire and act, as many have in the past. That the political party that takes this challenge on is almost surely to be re-elected. A Chinese proverb says, if we do not change direction, we'll end up where we are heading. None of us wants to be sick so long and die so young. The ship of state needs to change direction. Nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. Don't mourn or agonize. We must organize or die. Thank you.
You were just listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on healthcare in America. He spoke in Seattle in late September. Stephen Bezruska is on the faculty of the Department of Health Systems and Population Health at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He's the author of Inequality Kills Us All. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuke, Jesse Hagopian, Amy Goodman, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on Healthcare in America, and for his book, Inequality Kills Us All, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Jesse Wells, United Health.
There's an office in a building and a person in a chair, and you paid for it all, though you may be unaware. You paid for the paper, you paid for the phone, you paid for everything they need to deny what you owe. They know you in United Health, they know me in the company, they know us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity. The procedure that you're needing ain't the cost-effective route, and only 2% of people end up winning a dispute. So if you get sick, pray to God for help, 'cause your doctor's gotta pray to United Health. Way back in 77, Mr. Richard T. Burke started buying HMOs, putting federal grants to work, made 50 billion buckaroos. Last year, the Warren Buffett of health, the Jeff Bezos of fear.
Framing is a presentation of information. What's said and how it's said. Whose voice is heard, who's not. The thing that was so noticeable in my study of the coverage of the cultural heritage destruction in Artsakh and in Gaza was that invariably in the corporate and legacy media reporting, values that were missing were human rights, humanitarianism, and oftentimes journalistic ethics.
That's Misha Jirakulis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Misha Jirakulis on media framing of cultural destruction, Artsakh and Gaza. Artsakh, also known as Nagorno-Karabakh, is an historic Armenian area located in the Caucasus Mountains. In 2023, Azerbaijan invaded and ethnically cleansed the millennial-old Armenian population. The so-called civilized West looked the other way. Looking away has been harder to do in Gaza because of the enormity of the Israeli attack and the sheer scale of death and destruction. The Israeli goal in Gaza and the Azerbaijani goal in Artsakh is cultural and physical erasure. Both Artsakh and Gaza are reported as though they're just happening in a vacuum. By not providing context and background, journalists are guilty of media malpractice. Our guest today is Misha Jirakulis. She's a human rights journalist and critical media literacy expert. She's managing editor of Project Censored, the media watch and education organization. She's the author of Media Framing, and the destruction of cultural heritage, news narratives about Artsakh and Gaza. She spoke in Teaneck, New Jersey in mid-September 2025. The moderators were Mark Mamigonian and Henry Terrio. And now, Misha Jirakulis.
As an American of Armenian heritage, the events and after effects.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From Belen, Brazil, the gateway to the Amazon.